In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
You already love the Mixing Music podcast, but what if I told you that there are over 250 exclusive episodes just waiting for you? That's right. On our Patreon, you get ad-free technical deep dives every single week on mixing, mastering, and production. If you want more knowledge, more techniques, and zero fluff, head to mixingmusicpodcast.com/exclusive and start leveling up your skills today. Mixing Music Podcast. I'm your host, DK, and with me, as always, is my lovely co-host, Let It Go Lou.
Oh, yeah.
Let it go, brother.
Hey, man, listen, I was at the mountaintops not too long ago, but I guess I missed the opportunity to sing it. I should have done
it
that.
Let it go. You're talking about the song.
Yeah, I should have sang that in the Swiss Alps and sent that video to my little nieces who sing that song all the time. I think that had been one of those like, ooh, fun uncle memory.
I thought you were alluding to one of my favorite Instagram pages that I've discovered the last year, which is at Scenic Pisses. Have you seen this?
Oh my God. I'm not sending a video of that to my nieces.
So you're like, oh yeah, let it go on the mountaintop. I'm like, what, you peeing off the mountaintop?
Actually, I could have submitted that to the Instagram page too. I'm seeing so many missed opportunities. Okay, somebody plan what I should be doing in Arizona. I'm going to be in Lake Havasu Friday and Tucson on Saturday.
Yeah, there you go. All right, so this is a really interesting topic. I think it's an important topic. I think it's a problem that we all come across from time to time, and how to deal with this, how to think about this. We're going to give some tough love on this, but we're also going to be pretty nuanced and be real on this. I have some pretty strong biases in one direction versus another. There are some, my ideas and biases are more based on the philosophy of working on art and music as an art form. And then some of my other perspective and biases are more from the perspective of like business and income, which if I have to create a hierarchy and a priority list, is significantly less important and lower on the hierarchy, personal hierarchy of things that I find important. Income is less important than the desire to do more for art. So, like, understand that that's my personal bias. Lou's going to play the contrarian here, going to extrapolate or agree with me or disagree and why.
I might have my own views. Yeah.
You should. You do have your own views.
I do. But yeah. Maybe some that are points that we haven't touched on your end yet.
Yeah. So, yeah. Lou, do you ever get asked to work? I mean,
duh. I've said no plenty
Everybody
of times.
Has. Well, you not only have you said no to projects, but you've had requests to work on songs that are bad. Either bad ideas and writing and just like not a good song, or just bad recordings where like the audio itself is poorly recorded. Let's talk about these and the different ways that you've reacted in the past.
Mm-hmm. So I'll give, I think, the most common, I guess you could say the common experience when it comes to this. It's something that's so relatable to everyone that I think it's happened to everyone at least once, which is an unmanaged expectation from the client's end during the communication phase, where you're saying, okay, cool, you want me to work with you. Can I hear the reference? Like, where you guys have it right now? And you ask the age-old question, is there any inspiration? Is there specific sound you're after? Do you want it to sound like your previous releases? If so, can I hear your previous releases? Like, let me know what's going on. Recently, I had a track that somebody sent me, and I asked them, like, hey, like, is there any specific sound you're after? Like, this is the first time we're working together, so I just kind of want to ask you a few questions about, like, your expectations, just so we can see where this lands in that. Because when I first heard it, I could hear the AC in the background. I could hear, like, a low buzz, like, in the recording. And I'm just like, this is not ideal unless you're trying to be Gautier with, like, really mid-rangey, filtered out kind of sounds. And, you know, it's not going to work if you're trying to go Ariana Grande clarity. Like, it's just not going to be possible. When he told me he wanted a Kid Laroi kind of sound, I was like, ooh, you're going to have to re-record this. Like, it, like the takes sound cool, but it doesn't actually sound like it was recorded in, like, a quiet environment. They're like, yeah, I recorded it in my room. It was a hot day. I had the windows open and I had the fan blowing above me trying to cool down the air. And I was like, were you, like, standing right underneath the fan? He's like, yes. I was like, okay, I can't. This is a situation where I'm sorry, I don't like turning away work, but I also don't like accepting money for something where the expectations are beyond what I believe is going to be possible.
Yeah, like, I've heard stories, and I have on my own personal stories of saying no, because of the expectations, as you said. Like, yeah, the client,
in this case,
wants
it was just
more
a poor recording.
Give. And maybe they want some sort of magic to be done, and it's magic that I personally cannot do. Like, I'm able to perform other magic, like, that other engineers can't do. As a singer, that someone that uses Melodyne quite often, I can perform some tuning magic.
Yeah.
Right? Other engineers cannot do. And so I think it also comes from a place of, like, understanding your own limitations and what you've specialized in and niched in, which you need to understand, like, what you're comfortable with, what you're insecure with, like, or have, like, because if you got, like, low self-esteem or low confidence in your ability, then you'll actually be afraid to admit you can't do something. And that's against the best interests of the artist and the person that is asking for the service, as well as for the service in itself.
Yeah.
There's oftentimes, I mean, the nuance to that, and in contrast, like, if you're, like, a college student or you're someone that's young, I think that most experiences, it's like when it's, like, the first time you've never tuned vocals professionally before, like, if it's the first or second time, I would argue that possibly just say yes to everything.
Yeah. Trial by fire.
Yeah, possibly. And then save your
nose. I mean,
don't
do it on a big name. Like, don't step on your own foot too hard.
Or who's to say? Maybe that's, like, the reason why they do really well is because they say yes to a big name, and then someone puts in, like, 20 hours of research on how to do this one thing, and it turns out to go well. Who's to say?
True.
Right? Like, these are the sort of things that you should be thinking about. Like, I think, for one, to your points, like, communicating with the client is really, really important, because you may find out, like, it's not actually their lack of ability, but it's more of, like, it's just unfamiliar to us. Mm-hmm. So it's like, when is the difference between, like, low effort and unfamiliar? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Or, like, is the artist being careless and, like, purposefully careless, or just, like, being new and, like, being a noob?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, so it's like, when is the idea of, like, when is our ego getting in the way? I do think, on a personal bias level, I think that our job, especially our job, where throughout our career, like, a producer who's, like, doing the creating, right? Being creative, writing the song with the artist potentially. Like, they have to be, I think it's okay to be a little bit less open-minded than the mix engineer and definitely the mastering engineer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mastering engineer and mixing engineers, just logistically, are going to come across a wider genre of songs, like a wider collection of genres to work on, and a wider range of artists and sounds.
Mm-hmm.
Tons of different recording engineers, tons of different producers, just like the nature of the craft, right? So, like, to a certain degree, we have to be more open-minded than, like, that one recording engineer, that one producer, that one songwriter who typically, like, kind of stays in a niche, mm-hmm. right? We have to be really, really open-minded, because also we're the last member of the collection of steps to make a completed record. Like, if we have to honor all of the steps and all of the intensity and intention that came before us, and it would be disrespectful to be like, no, we know more than every single other person that was in this long, long line of process before us.
Yeah.
So it's this really strange and important part, integral part of this huge machine. And I think oftentimes people don't realize that part of our job is to be open-minded. What do you think about that, Lou? Is that fair to say?
I think it's fair to say, especially when it comes down to, like, after running in the mix for years and, you know, being at a bunch of different studios, it's true. Like, a lot of the recording cats and producers, they're very, very niched. And it's not always that you run into, like, even producers that just skip genres. You know what I mean? Like, they can go to hip hop, to jazz, to this, to that. And because of that, I feel like those guys tend to have, like, a very niche sense of, like, success, because they pave ways in, like, genre blending that becomes like, oh, you go to them for this specific sound too, because they're the only ones that can jump between the XYZ genres and found a way to blend them. But as mixers, as mastering engineers, like, especially mastering engineers, like you said, like, as you get to the final step, it's like, you're not really deciding what the record is going to sound like. You're just kind of coming in at the last end of it. The artist has already signed off on the production. The producer's already signed off on the production. The mixer has already mixed it. And the final balancing of everything, how much reverb, how punchy the kick is, and all that kind of stuff has already been decided. So even then, as a mastering engineer, you just have to be very, very conscious of, like, hey, okay, if we are going for a target loudness in this case versus, like, an overall balance as an album, you know, approaching the single mindset versus the album mindset, like, how do we approach this to where, like, we don't want to over-squish? We don't want to, in the hopes of loudness, we don't want to not squish enough because it's an album and we're trying to keep the balance of the album alive without sacrificing too many dynamics. Like, you know, at that point, yeah, sure. You definitely had to have an open mind to different genres. You probably had to, like, listen to a lot more different music and be a fan of a lot more different music just to have even a good reference point just kind of ingrained in you already.
Yeah.
Yeah. But with that said, would you say no to a genre that you're not ultimately familiar with as an established engineer, like in the mixing side? At what point does saying yes become a detriment to your reputation?
Yeah, like an opportunity for growth versus a problem for the artist.
Yeah.
Or you can look at it, or you can look at it as, like, your specialty in doing hip hop works really well because it'll naturally make a fusion of something within the realm of rock. Like, when does it say that your unfamiliarity is actually a good thing to, you know, to the art itself? Right?
Yeah. So something like that would be like, if you got an overly rock guy to do the Linkin Park Jay-Z collaborative, almost like remix album, really is what it came down to. But, like, you can't just go overly rock on that one. You can't go overly hip hop on that one either. You have to, at a certain point, maybe there was like a TZO Baines type collaboration between the engineers to find, like, hey, we like Chris's vocals this way. We like Thug's vocals this way. You know, at what point are they trading roles in order for the best end result as a unified project? It's kind of like, you know me, I like rock a lot. I grew up on rock and hip hop, both. And I think that's kind of what's helped with, like, mixing for Exhibit recently, where it's like, I know what the drummer wants in his ears. I know what drums should sound like when they're big and hit hard and everything, but they're not so loud and harsh on the cymbals and this and that. Like, I know how to actually mix live drums.
Yeah.
But I've worked with so many hip hop artists that I actually know what they like too. So when I'm mixing his ears, I make it sound like what a hip hop artist wants in his ears. When I make it for the front of house, I make it sound like what it sounds like to hear a live band performing hip hop. So there is places where, like, familiarity with different genres actually helps out with, like, a final balance of things. But when it comes to production, familiarity with different things, I like using it, Terrace Martin as an example. He's a jazz guy doing hip hop, which is really cool. He's on tour as Herbie Hancock's saxophonist and keyboardist, But then he's also working with like Kamasi Washington doing orchestral arrangements and stuff like that. And then he's out here doing To Pimp a Butterfly and other Kendrick projects.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's really cool that
it's really beneficial.
The producer can have that kind of range. But because of that, you also see Terrace in this niche thing.
There's also something to be said about like understanding at a certain point, like if they hire you, they understand the value that you're giving. So it's like, yeah. Yes, if you're like the wrong genre, that you typically do a different genre, for example, and you're mm-hmm. known for that genre, that specific sound, and someone who is historically not at all aligned with that genre and sound, they probably picked you on purpose because they want to change, like as an artistic creative decision. So there's something lines to be like something to be said about yeah. that too. But I want
it'd be
to, I want
important to have a conversation at that point to set
exactly.
expectations,
which is your original point, right? The communication. Yeah. I want to like kind of to put it into perspective to make this. I want to like I love doing like metaphors and contrast and like talk about it in different industries.
The rabbit in the woods.
Yeah, what? Rabbit of the woods. I like to talk about that specifically because things that are difficult to understand because we're so close to it, like it's so right up in our face, we can't see beyond like the myopic viewpoint mm-hmm. that we have. Okay, so think about it like this. Like a mix engineer that is like, no, I don't want to do this, or like I need to change everything. Imagine like a color correcting person, like for mm-hmm. film and TV. There's like an entire movie that was written, that was scripted, that was acted, that was edited, that was directed. There was actual like, what do you call that? Like the art of like camera movement and like mm-hmm. picking the lens, cinematography in general, all of this stuff that was done. And then the color corrector is like, no, this is all wrong. I need to
change
it.
It's too blue.
No, this needs to be more blue, even though it's originally warm. I just disagree that the director said that yeah. this film should be colored warm. I think it should be a cool color. Like, that's just ridiculous. And yeah. it's stupid. That's not the job, you know? So it's like, there's something to be said about that. So like, if you are a mix engineer or a mastery engineer, and you're like, dishonoring the entire process that came before you, that's kind of what it's like. You need mm-hmm. to understand that your job is important and it is crucial. And there is something to be said about when the color corrector decides to use their own creativity and make a move that maybe the director didn't intend, but that does improve the story and the storytelling. But that's very limited, right?
Yeah.
The only reason why that's not necessarily a good metaphor is because I do think that mixing has a bigger emotional impact to a song and the final product than the editor does, or than the color correcting guy does. I'm not like, this is not saying that the color correcting job is less important, but what I am saying is that there's less people in the process of making a song, and thus when there's less process, each individual process when making a song is more important as in the whole.
Yeah.
So there's something to be said. I think like mixers can make creative decisions. Jason Joshua is a mediocre example actually at that. But like Jason Joshua is at least famous for saying, fuck your rough mix. I'm here to make hits. I'm not here to make your rough mix sound better. And then there's people like Serban and people like Manny who like do a really, really good job making rough mixes and like original ideas, just like basically finalizing them.
Yeah.
Like borderline not mixing them, just finalizing them, just making the last little touches and giving the stamp of approval. And there's something to be said about the value of that too. There's also something to be said about like the further up the ladder you go, the value becomes more quality control and project management than it does about changing and fixing things.
Yeah.
Like at the lower levels, it's about changing and fixing things. And that's an important skill to learn. But at the higher level, it's more about quality control and project management.
You know, it's very true what you said, because I just got as far as the communication and management of the project, just because I recently just had a conversation with an artist where, you know, somebody involved in the project, there's a few people involved in this project that are all in communication with me. But the relationship that I've had with this artist has always been, I talk to them, they talk to me. If there's any concerns, we talk to each other. And if anybody else in the production has any concerns or anything, she would prefer that they communicate with her. And then if she agrees with them, she will then communicate it with me. And people who understand how their clients like to work is a big reason why they would be willing to pay more it's not always about the quality of the work, but rather the I guess the consistency in keeping a workflow the way that works best for the client. So if that means that the producer of the track says, hey, I think the kick needs to be a little bit louder, it's like, hey, why don't you go ahead and relay that to them. I make changes based off of the client's needs, and that's how they prefer to do things. In this case, if I was working with another client and they were open to you just giving me notes directly, then totally cool. But this is how they prefer to work.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm just respecting this chain of command, so to speak. It's not that we are ultimately obedient. We're not allowed to talk to each other. I'll talk to you. I understand where you're coming from, but I just can't make a change without their approval.
That's correct. Yeah. So like, yeah. It's process, again, project management, project, process, workflow, especially as you go up. But at the beginning, it is a lot about fixing. So let's be clear about this.
Yeah.
Our job isn't necessarily, it is about taste, but it's not about taste. It's really weird. Let's talk about the nuance of that. We have taste. Tastes are natural. Tastes are unavoidable. We have preferences. Yeah. Even my Down syndrome four-year-old likes some songs and doesn't like other songs. Taste isn't an unavoidable tinted glass that we always have to look through. Yeah. And sometimes that's to our benefit, sometimes it's not, but we have to understand that we are looking through a tinted glass, right? A rose-colored glasses or whatever they're called.
Oh, I was about to say rose-colored glasses when all the red flags suddenly just look the same as the white flags.
Okay. Yeah. So our job, so here's the thing. We are not A&R. We are not the audience.
Yeah.
To a certain degree, we're like audio surgeons. We are the intersection of technical understanding and creative endeavor. Mm-hmm. That's what it is. We are the final intersection of technical understanding and creative endeavor in the creation of a record, mixing and mastering in general. I would argue that this is just an argument, so this is not objectively true. Mixing is the last... balanced or more creative process than mastering. Mastering is going to be heavily more technical. Yes, there's some creative, but it's still going to be heavily more technical than mixing. Yeah. So this is, it's like a really important and strange intersection that we are at with mixing.
Yeah.
You have to have the confidence to say, this is my style, but I know how to make this hit harder. There is a few specific anecdotal moments where it might be in your best interest to say no, especially in the beginning and intermediate phase. And this can only be discovered with experience and deep communication or both. Typically both, right? One example is what Lou said. There is a huge, through communication, you find out there is a huge high expectation that either your skill level cannot accommodate for, and you have to be open to that, or your desire to learn cannot accommodate for.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you have a song where the drums are really out of time and they refuse to hire a good session drummer because their pride of keeping the band member that they love and they didn't want to let him not record on the record.
That's such a tough decision to make.
That's a tough decision. That's objective, especially
I've had to make the decision against our own drummer in the past, and it's not a fun decision to come to.
I think a lot of musicians and a lot of bands have had to make decisions like that. That's a fair, tough decision to have to come across. So that's a fair, tough decision. So like now your job as the mixer is like, okay, am I capable of editing the drums? Is this bullshit that I'm willing to deal with? Because like if you're not being paid enough or you don't like that process or you hate it or you don't have pride in your work, you're not naturally going to want to say yes, or like you're not willing to learn how to do that, then it may be in your best interest to say no. Because at the end of the day, your job as a service provider and like what brings clients back and what keeps clients from talking shit about you and like kind of spreads goodwill among the community and gets you more clients, like makes you more money in the long term, is by providing greater and greater and greater service. And if because of, you know, the lack of skill, the lack of desire, the lack of like alignment or whatever, if you know that you're going to do a mediocre job on a service level and like client satisfaction level, you're just not going to be emotionally invested in this project, is the only time that I would recommend saying no. Because it is better to work on projects where you know for certain you're going to enjoy it enough that you provide great customer service, great communication, great customer service, your best effort, even if they don't like it. I would always take the risk that you working on projects that you do your best effort than it is where even if you know you're going to do a good job, but you're going to put in zero effort and thus you're going to provide bad customer service. Like that's when I think that's the line for me. And that's what I recommend people making the line for. Like, and again, at the intersection of creative and technical, I would work on your ability. Like, this is why we always say like therapy is really good, or like understanding your viewpoints and understanding your insecurities and your tastes. Because at the same time, I really do believe, and I'm going to encourage and insist that our job of mixers is to be open-minded, is to be well-studied, well-versed, have a large repertoire of understanding different genres and sounds and artists and trends from a technical and emotional level, and be able to dip into all of that and be able to provide high customer. Like, it is our job to be open-minded. It is not our jobs to be critics. It is not our jobs to be the audience. We are not A&R. It's not our job to predict which songs and artists are going to be worldwide hits and which ones are not. And at the end of the day, Lou, what is the question that almost every single artist, producer, A&R, especially at the intermediate and beginner level, asks? That they always ask us when they're trying to determine if they want to work with us. It's such a stupid question. Do you like the song?
Oh, no, I wasn't going to say that.
What? What do you think?
How much do you charge?
Oh, no, I wasn't even going to say that. I think it starts off with, what do you think of my song? Do you like my song? Do you get that question all the time?
I actually do. And I have been brutally honest in the past, more recent years, just for my own personal sanity. And maybe that's rude. Maybe that's rude. But I would rather be honest and say, hey, this isn't something that I typically listen to. And for that reason, I don't know if I'm the best person to work on it, as it's not really a genre that I personally really indulge in. I could work on this. I could make it sound better. I see where it's lacking, where it can go. But to be 100% honest with you, I could recommend you to somebody who can work on this genre a bit better than I can because they have more experience working in this genre. A good example of this is like folk music. I'm not a folk guy. I have nothing against folk music. I just don't actually listen to it. And one could say that regional Mexican music could be considered just Mexican folk. Sure, but the approach to that music is also extremely different than, you know, what we find as folk in America. If somebody asks me if I like their song or not, I'll try to be as brutally honest as I can, because I have told people no in the past. Maybe that's rude.
No, I think it's fair. I think some artists, and it's not, I don't
think
it's
a dumb question, though.
I don't, well.
Hear me out. The question is, do you feel comfortable working on this song or not? I think as asking a better question. Are you comfortable with this style of music?
Yeah, you know what? I think that really is a better question. I agree.
But if you asked me if I like the song or not, if you showed me, because I'm not a Taylor Swift hater, but I really just don't personally like this song, and I understand how catchy it is because it's always stuck in my head. That's one that goes, "Player's gonna hey, 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 hey." You know, it's like, yeah, that's definitely like a hit, and like I would want to work on it on the sense of like that sounds like it's gonna do really well. But if you ask me if I like it, the answer is no. Like, if I said, am I comfortable working with a song like this? Yeah, I'm comfortable working with a song like that.
Yeah.
But asking if somebody likes your music is not the right question.
So the reason why I'm going to side the other way, which is like, I think it's a fair question to ask and kind of be contrarian to your point on that point, is because most of our audience is mixers. So they're not going to be asking mixers. So I can't say like you should be asking mixers if they feel comfortable working on this instead of do you like the song? Because most of our listeners and our audience are going to be asked, do you like this song? Yeah. And I think that's like an unavoidable human trait that people have. across all generations and will continue to have. So one, we have to recognize that a lot of artists are really insecure. We talked about that before, or like seek validation. We work in the music industry. Like, this is a cool industry that we work in, especially here in the West. People do this for validation, whether you like it or not. You're going to come across that question, especially if you're trying to do this professionally. I don't think it's a dumb question, nor do I think we should approach it by like, oh, this is like a low IQ, low self-esteem guy. I think we should like approach it sincerely. I think it's fair. What is not our task is to determine whether or not the person asking that question likes brutal honesty or wants to be lied to. That's not our task. Our task is based on our personal values, we should have integrity. So if for some people, like it may be you, it may be for like Greasy Will, which is like brutally honest, and which may be disagreeable, and that might be a reason why someone likes you. That might be a reason why someone hates you. It's not our job to cater to what someone likes. It's our job to have integrity. And for some people like me, I'm going to be on the opposite hand, which is like, I don't lie. I never lie. I will never lie. But if someone says, I don't like this, I will honestly say the elements of the song that I do like. I like the lyrics. I like where the drums are at right now. I like where the song is going. I think the idea and the topic of the song is dumb. I don't know if it's going to go and hit the billboards. But I've also mixed tons of records where I thought that, and then those are the songs that have hit billboard charts and done really, really well. And I've had tens, if not hundreds of millions of streams. Like, it's just like, I'm not a good guesser of what songs will pop off. So I think understanding that too. There's also, here's the nuance I'm going to address. People don't address this a lot. I'm going to start off with the metaphor of a movie that I like. There's a Studio Ghibli movie that I really, really love. That is really hard to watch, that is really sad, that's really dark. It's famously dark. It's called Grave of the Fireflies. It's the perspective of like a 6 to 8 year old brother and like a 4 year old sister. And it's World War II time. Airplanes drop fire, napalms, burns down the village. Parents get burned in a fire. The 8 year old brother, 6 to 8 year old brother, and the 4 year old young sibling sister moves to live with an abusive aunt and uncle. Nobody has money in Japan at the end of World War II, so they don't have food to provide for these newly orphaned nephew and niece, right? So if it was a Disney story, the kids would stop the abuse, run away from the abusive aunt and uncle, and then find a better life. This is a realistic and interesting movie, actually, from a writing perspective. They leave the life. They steal from the aunt and uncle. They run away. And the moral of the story is, this is fucking wartime. If you had taken some shit, like if you had just been patient with the abuse and accepted the abuse for just a few months, you wouldn't have been responsible for the death of your little sister.
Yeah.
Like you having not, like you having the pride to think life could be better during wartime led to the death of your sister and yourself. That is a really brutal story and a really sad story. But there's something to be said about that. Sometimes when we are in wartime, when we have mouths to feed, like children or wives or rent to pay and, debt to pay off or whatever, we have to say yes to things that we don't want to do. This is a reality and a nuance that is there that you're going to come across at different times. Objectively, this is a horrible mind frame to stay in. You should not stay in this. Like, you do not want to make creative decisions based on income or thinking about income. That does not serve the art. That does not serve the client. That does not serve anyone. It is actively poison against yourself and the art from a philosophical level. You should never do that. But I understand that many of us at different times in our life have to think like that. It's an unavoidable part of the growth of our creative careers. This is something you're going to have to deal with. This is something that I don't really have like objective advice that works across all situations. But I do think it's fair to say that this is a bad mind frame and a bad way of thinking that you should, if at all costs, avoid. Making broke boy decisions is when people make bad decisions. When you make decisions because of money, bad decisions. When you like pick roommates because you want to save more money, that's usually when the roommates are bad. When you pick on, you know what I'm saying? Like, you don't want to make broke boy decisions. You don't want to break relationships or burn relationships because of money issues.
Now, I will say that there is a time and place where money is the reason you should say no.
Of course, of course. That's from like a more protective mindset. But I'm talking about when money causes you to be in a defensive mode.
Oh,
when
no.
you're like preemptively burning bridges because you don't even want to take the risk of losing money on this. Or like, you know, so that's something to be said. But it's something to admit. We've all done that from time to time. Lou and I have done that time to time. But and luckily we're in positions where we get to say no to that sort of stuff and we can avoid those sort of things.
Yeah.
But that is like a very blessed... what's the word I'm looking for? Entitled
experience.
Position to come from, an earned position, or lucky to be lucky.
It's a stage that we're in.
Yeah. And yeah, just
I'm sure there will be another stage after that.
Yeah. So there's something to be said about wartime and accepting when we have to say yes during wartime.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is, in art, we are not soldiers.
Yeah.
We have to face wartime, but we are not soldiers. Okay, I think that's fair enough about that topic, right?
Now, I will say, just to add one, where just saying why we should say no when it comes to finances, and this is more of a mentality, not a pocketbook or a bill thing. Something that I've always kind of acknowledged after it was told to me, if you remember Gerald Keyes, me and him had a conversation roughly 13 years ago. And me and him, I'm not going to lie. I've always had a certain amount of love for Gerald, the same way that I've had with you, where we would play devil's advocate to each other's ideas and viewpoints, how we like to approach things and how they differ. But we never like were at a point that we just didn't like each other. We just either agreed, we didn't agree, but we always respected each other's viewpoints. And the thing that he told me was, I remember him telling me about how somebody offered him a certain amount of money. And at the time, you know, consider this is 12, 13 years ago, minimum wage was like $8. Now it's almost 20 at McDonald's. Like, times are very different, but, so wild that it changes that fast. But either way, he told me a number that he was offered and he turned it down. And I was in my head kind of baffled. I'm like, you realize that was like 3 days worth of work, right? Like, you just turned down 3 days worth of work in exchange for like 4 hours of your time. He's like, it's not that. I don't like accepting things for less than I think it's actually worth, because then my mindset, my approach, my actual work ethic completely changes. And it's something that I can't really avoid. If I know that I feel like I'm being undervalued or anything, I start to work very differently. And it's something that is just inherently going to happen. It's not because I don't like this person. It's not because I want to turn in a bad service. In fact, the reason I'm turning it down is because I know that I'm bound to not put as much attention, love, or even attempt to treat it the same way as if I was getting paid my asking rate. It's not that I'm trying to be stingy. It's not trying to gatekeep anything. It's just that I think the work is valued at this. And if I feel like people are just trying to lowball me and I feel undervalued, then that's it. I don't mind breaking a deal for people I really want to work with, which I did the other day, even myself, where you set a minimum to what you're willing to accept, to where you feel like you're still comfortable doing the same work, ethic and approach. You're not going to change anything about your workflow at this minimum price point. But when it seems like people are looking just for a deal and you're not really that into the project to begin with, like they sometimes you get a project where you're not really that into it and they can afford it. Cool, that happens. But sometimes you get offered a project you're not that into and they can't afford you. So they try to, you know, negotiate something. If you know going in that because you're not getting at the very least, nobody's hitting your minimum, you shouldn't accept the project, even if it is $300. It could be tough times. If you're going to turn in a poor service, lack in communication, it's going to fall below the standard of what you deliver to everyone else. You should not accept the money, even if it really comes down to it and you feel like you're being undervalued just on a price point. Like, forget all the other details. You think you're just, for whatever reason, you personally feel, this may not even be the case, but you just feel like you're being undervalued. And because of that, you know that you're not going to turn in the same level of service. Just say no.
there's something to be said about usually frustrations in the service industry come from clients crossing over boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
So one, we have boundaries that we have. We do not do this. We're okay with this. Like some engineers are really okay working overnight, like late into the night. They like that. And then some people like only work 9 to 5. Some people don't mind the 24-hour, 48-hour like due dates for an album, you know, just like crunch time stuff. Or at least not, maybe not don't mind, but like are okay with it and can tolerate that.
As long as they're compensated for it, yeah.
Yeah, tolerate that. And there's something to be said about like there's more compensation for being able to tolerate things.
Yeah.
That was like the Dale Becker quote, like sometimes we have too many boundaries too early. Mm-hmm. But there's also the idea that like, yes, usually people get frustrated when people cross boundaries. And when do people cross boundaries? It's usually through under communication. People typically don't communicate their boundaries, don't communicate well, don't protect themselves. Just being generally too agreeable, which is not a bad thing, but can be hurtful if you allow other people to take advantage of you or even feel like people are taking advantage of you when most of the time they're not doing it intentionally. There's also, I wanted to say something else. You hit on a really good point that I wanted to extrapolate on or like talk about. I wanted to extrapolate. I'm forgetting. Let's move
is
on.
Is it that the color purple is just so cool?
Yeah, it's the color purple is so cool.
Yeah. I knew it.
Okay. Let's see here. Let's see here. It's like, okay, let me talk about how I perceive songs and like where my strengths and weaknesses lie and why that benefits me. And just so you could think about this too, like I would be a horrible A&R. I am extremely open-minded. I am deeply creative. That it's very hard to show me a song that one, I don't like, or two, I can't imagine myself liking after I work on it. I either be like, wow, this is awesome, I'd love to work on it, or like, wow, this sucks right now, but the fact that it sucks right now gets me excited because maybe I have a little bit of a savior complex. Like, I want to fix this and save
the
your
Captain
life.
Captain Save-A-Ho of mixing?
Yeah, Captain Save-A-Ho of mixing, whatever. Whatever the reason, those are the two things. Very rarely do I hear a song that's so uninspiring that I just don't like it and I don't feel like I can... there's any value in me fixing it. Very rarely does that ever happen. And it's mostly based on like the mindset of the person asking. So like when someone says, do you like this song? It's like kind of a mixed bag. Sometimes it shows insecurity. And like you said previously, like deeply insecure songs or like songs that people are uncertain, they're not going to like the mix. Like if they didn't like the song to begin with, they're not going to like the mix no matter who mixed it, no matter how well you mixed it. So it might be speaking on that and I have to determine that. There's a couple clients that I work with when they ask that question, it's a red flag. There's also a couple other people where it's like, do you like this song? And they're asking sincerely because they want to work with someone that also believes in the song. And so I need to determine that. So what I'm really good at is being super open-minded. I hear bad audio quality. I hear bad songwriting. I hear bad, just Logic kick drum samples, just horrible. Right. And I find I have
Logic kick drum samples is so,
yeah.
I'm sorry. If you guys have been listening to the podcast since the beginning of its, inception, you know, that DK has a specific hate for Logic kick drum samples.
Do not use the default stock Logic kick drum samples.
Like,
I hate
it's
them.
Just, it's such a uniquely niche fun fact of DK's life. You're not a fan of the podcast if you haven't heard that one before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so let's say they're doing that because they don't know better. And, okay, so let's say that they're doing that. Now I forgot what I'm talking about. Hold on. So I get excited for it. I have this great strength to like get excited for it and be open-minded. It works against my like A&R skill, who should be pretty prejudiced and be able to say, this is a good song, this is not a good song. Because it's about like what serves the label best or like what can potentially blow up and pop off and protect the branding of the artist. For me, I don't have that need and I would be a bad A&R. I'm not good at prejudicing which songs are going to be good, which songs are going to be bad. They're all pretty good to me. I like clowncore. I like alternative jazz. Like it's pretty hard for me to have some strong negative biases because you send me a pretty silly country song. You know, like when I like
I'm
weird
down by the lake.
If I like clowncore, I'm going to like some songs that are just not even inside the genres that I typically like. Like I'm not a big country listener, but if it's a good country song, I'm going to say it's a good country song, you know? Like I'm going to think that. That's a good strength that I have. A weakness that I have is I didn't think about this. Let me think about it on the spot.
I'll tell you about mine.
Oh, is that I have a hard time being over-believing in projects. Like, just like you, I'm honest, and I will not say absolutely I believe in it. I'm not the type of guy that'll brown nose you. I will not brown nose you. If I don't think it's a fantastic song, I won't tell you it's a fantastic song. That being said, I will tell you if I think it's a good song that with our collaboration, I know that we can make great. Like, I'm pretty confident that I can turn good songs into great songs. Like, and I won't hide that. Lou, you were saying something.
I think the side that I think it would be my weakness is being a people pleaser.
A lot of people have this weakness.
Yeah, but not a lot of people like admitting to it. Let's just be honest. Not,
and I don't necessarily think it's a weakness off the bat.
Well,
I don't think it's a weakness off the bat. I think doing too much is a weakness.
I think people pleasers do too much. But hear me out on it. Hear me out. I'll explain. Okay. Maybe you'll agree. Before really coming to terms with the idea that I am a people pleaser, I would go above and beyond for things I really just didn't care about. I heard that.
Yeah, my bad, brother.
That was actually kind of funny.
My bad.
For all of you out there, sisters. DK just looked like he played in the Lakers.
What?
You were squirting a Gatorade bottle straight into your mouth, and all you hear is... like he just had that Space Jam super juice.
No, this is my preferred bottle of recently, so I change out water bottles. I don't like the straws because they get bacteria in them over time. Yep. They get stinky. I don't like the bottles that are hard to reach inside because bacteria and stinky. First off, this doesn't even touch your lips most of the time because it just squirts into your mouth, so there's less bacteria entering it on it. It's easy to clean because there's no straw. It's just good bottle, and it's high capacity. So it's just a pragmatic approach. Go ahead.
It doesn't stop from looking cool when you just go from a distance.
Yeah, and the kids will like open their mouth from across the room and be like, "Daddy, give me some water," and I like try to shoot it and never make it. Whatever.
At least it's water and not like apple juice shooting across the room.
Yeah. It's not sticky substance.
But I think before acknowledging being a people pleaser, I would get into a lot of situations where like, I don't want to be in this situation, but I also don't want to say no. I don't want to look like I'm not a team player. I don't want to be the one that's throwing a wrench in the works because it might be something that pans out. There might be some logic to something, but did I truly believe in what I was working half the time? No. And part of that is being too much of a people pleaser. I think being a people pleaser as somebody who's providing a service is a huge detriment to the service and to the client. Because at the end of the day, once again, if you don't really care, just say no. Just be honest. Like, I think people would have a lot more respect for you if you were just honest and just said no, or said, you know what? It's not my cup of tea. But I know somebody who loves this flavor of tea. They love this Earl Grey with no sugar or any kind of sweetener because my not loving bitter ass tea drinking just doesn't want this bitter tea. Sorry, it's just not my thing. Some people are whiskey people. Some people are tequila people. Some people are this and that. Some people just hate the other one. But if you're going to sit there and be like, oh yeah, I'd love to work on this just because you want people to think that you're likable, you're actually kind of hurting yourself and the people around you. Just be honest. So at a certain point when you, and this is kind of like the positive strength that comes from it once you acknowledge it, it might be hard to start setting up boundaries at first because we had this conversation where I think for the two of us especially, like we started thinking about this a lot when Bob told us about his situation where, you know, he was working himself to the ground. And at a certain point, you know, I think it was like a late night revision or something. No, it was during the day that it happened to him when he got his stroke in his studio, where at a certain point you're working yourself to the core and you know, all this extra work that you're doing doesn't always amount to like this significant amount of success that's inherently coming to you. Like it might factor in some of it, but not all of it. So being a people pleaser is not a benefit unless it goes unchecked. If it goes unchecked.
At the cost of integrity.
Yeah. Yeah, which could be a detriment to your career at the end of the day.
It could be.
Yeah.
Could be. To your point, to a previous point, more importantly, but there's also in business, in the business world, there's the idea is like in order to say yes to a $2 million business deal, you have to say no to a $1 million business deal.
Yeah.
Which is scary. There's the thing. There's like nuance and balance to this, and you have to understand the size of the industry and of the like general supply and demand and where you stand in that. Yeah, like saying no to a $1 million deal to get offered a $2 million deal in the tech world is plausible. That's not really plausible in music, right? So it's not exactly one-to-one ratio.
Well,
but that's like, that is something, an interesting take to think about. Like, just because you decide what your bottom dollar is, just because you're going to decide to stop being a people pleaser and you like have a hard, this is my bottom dollar, do not say give deals below this. And you say that and you say no to someone doesn't mean, may mean that you're going to open yourself up to opportunities in the long term where you say yes to higher paid projects. So that's something to be said about. Like there's something to be said about that. I've lost to be fair, the beginning, the first 5 years of my, so I've been actively working as a mixer now, non-exclusively, like, so I did recording and producing too in my early years, non-exclusively for, about 10 years now, like professionally for about 10 years now, maybe a little bit less than 10 years professionally, maybe like 9 years professionally. But in the first 5 years, the clients that I had then, like specific clients, literal clients versus the clients that I have in the second half of my 5 years, I only think there's one or two that have stayed. Like my clients have shifted. The ones that have stayed, they like got better and progressed their career as much as and as quickly as I have. But for majority of my clients, I have progressed my career faster than they could keep up with. Yeah. There's a couple clients where they eventually caught up and started hiring me again later. But most of the clients that I had in the first half are completely different from the clients that I've had in the second half. And so that's another reality too. Like naturally, if you are progressing, people do not always progress their careers at the same speed you do. Some people progress their career faster than you do. So they're just, they hire someone more expensive and better, more experienced than you do. But this is something that you have to understand. Your clients will change over time and you shouldn't avoid that. And you shouldn't necessarily directly cater to that. Again, the exception being like wartime. Right. But this idea of like saying no to say yes later is important.
Yeah.
This is something that like management and just in general, like buyer philosophy, like customer philosophy, psychology that you should understand and think about is, once you give someone, there's a cognitive bias called anchoring. Once you say yes to your bottom dollar, let's say that my bottom dollar right now is $200, right? That's like a pretty good bottom dollar for a lot of listeners. Like $200. I don't say yes to anything below $200. I do not offer it. Let's say you say yes to $150 once, even though you've kind of decided that. For that client, for the rest of the life cycle of that client, it's going to be more difficult for them to agree to raising the price later, you know? So they're going to anchor to that $150 price.
Yeah.
Now let's say that you believe that you're at the $400 price range. They're never going to agree to that, or it's going to be very difficult to convince them that you are now $300 worth, 100% more expensive when they've anchored onto this $150 price point.
Oh, yeah.
So more often than not, the people who say yes to higher prices are going to be different people, not the same people that you convinced to pay more. Mm-hmm. That is way harder and way unlikely. That's just the nature of how it is. So think about that as well. This is why you don't say yes to anything below your bottom dollar and why you try to with first-time new clients, take the risk, like negotiate for yourself. If they say $400, if this was a video game and you have the option to negotiate a price for yourself, why wouldn't you take the risk of at least asking for slightly more?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? So like this is life. This is more important than a video game. So you should ask them, can you meet me in the middle? And instead of doing 200, can you do 300? Because I typically charge 500 or 350 or whatever.
Something that I've done recently for that was I set out to pitch for a tour, and the tour got approved. But when negotiating numbers, they're like, so how much is it to hire you, this and that? I told them what I'd normally charge, this and that. They're like, you know, right now we're kind of in a position where this is the first time that we're doing something like this. Is there any room for negotiation? I'm like, listen, I could do X because I had already pre-qualified, like, what's the per diem, the travel date pay, all that kind of stuff. And I've found a way that balances out fairly nice for everyone. But when I sent off the invoice after like halfway through the shows, because I negotiated like, hey, I need a deposit a halfway and then a final pay the day I arrive back to LA. When they sell the invoice, the first invoice I sent over, they're like, hey, I thought you had agreed to this price. I'm like, yes, but I kept my natural price there and I showed on the adjustments the reduction in price. And I put in the notes that this was a one-time agreement for this specific project, which starts on this date and ends on this date. This price is not valid for the rest. And since then, the client has been hiring me at my normal rate ever since. Not the discounted rate, you know? So if you are ever going to discount, you have to set like a very clear communication because, you know, DK is right. Once somebody knows that they can get you for a certain price, it is harder. It's not impossible, but it is significantly harder to get them to pay your regular price without prior communication and expectations set, without putting some level of strain on the relationship, depending on how everything went the first time, you know, because there are artists that send me mixes or songs to mix, and I listen to it. And this happened the other day, which I was a little upset by, but understood. So this client didn't want to show me the songs that they're actually working on for fear of like a leak for whatever reason. So the song that they sent me was a really, really good song. Like I actually really liked the song, the arrangement styles, everything, the musicianship, everything about it was so good. I was like, hey, I know you said your budget is this. I don't accept anything under XYZ anymore. Like just in general, like it's just not something I do, but I really, really, really like this song. So if we can agree to doing the first three songs together at this number, then I can agree to work on it. But with the clear understanding that after the third song, my price goes right back to normal. Like, but if that's only if we're doing these three songs, and this isn't something that I'm trying to negotiate for next year, this is within the next month. After this month, I cannot honor the same price point. You're more than welcome to shop around. I can give you referrals to anybody else if that seems to be a concern. But if you're trying to do this album, I'll do the first three songs for this price. And if you like the end results of those, we can keep working at my regular price. If not, once again, I'm happy to recommend you to other people. But that's when they told me, oh, the song you heard isn't actually the song in the album. I'm like, I would not have made you this offer had I known that. I would rather hear the songs we're working on because if I really don't like the songs, I would not have made that offer, which is why, once again, do you like the song is a weird question to me.
That's a bummer.
After that, I just told them like, can I hear the song? They're like, oh, well, not until we like hire somebody. I'm like, then no.
Yeah.
No, I'm not working on a blind date.
We also, this is going to be a shout out to our sponsor, File Pass.
Hell yeah.
In general, if you're interested in using Final Pass, File Pass, mixingmusicpodcast.com/File Pass. But basically, this is a cloud server storage thing like Dropbox, except for musicians, engineers, producers. You can lock the file so they can't download it. One way that I offer it is that I don't negotiate a price. I don't say, hey, I'll do it lower for this first couple songs. I have discounts, like I do bundles. So like I'll take off 10 to 20% off the price if you pay up front for three plus songs. That being said, what's really interesting is I'll do something if it's like a single or if it's going to be a potential good client. I'll be like, here's my price and my expectation of what I expect you to pay me. It's a big risk. It's a big risk for you to try a new engineer at that price point. I am going to take on the risk myself, right? Because it's about who takes the risk and who's responsible for the risk. Mm-hmm. I'll take the risk myself and I will mix this song for you. Here's the catch. You don't have to pay if you don't like it. You only pay if you like it. But if you like it and want to pay for it, you have to pay my full price. In the industry, mm-hmm. we call this a spec mix. And here's the thing, with something like File Pass, you can protect yourself because traditionally, this has been difficult to do because you have the risk of someone running off with the file. Even they say, I don't like it, and they run off with the file.
Mm-hmm.
With something like File Pass, you can lock the file. And so they cannot download it until they pay for it. Right? So now I could do spec mixes without and take on the risk. So they get to remove risk from hiring me. And then I also protect myself by locking the file. So they can't download and upload anywhere without my permission. Right. Another way you could do this previously is like huge audio tags, like big audio tags.
Put some pink noise in the most epic part of the chorus, somewhere where they can't just loop a section.
Yeah. So that being said, so there's like other ways of doing that, but like File Pass is like my favorite way of doing this. So then I could take on the risk. They don't have to take on the risk because most people don't want to take on the risk themselves, right? So I remove the risk. I remove the risk. They do it. And then most of the time they like it. I give them an opportunity to realize this is why I charge so much.
Do you remember that there was a mixer? I forget who it was. I remember it wasn't like a big, big mixer. It was like somebody that was coming up, but they were putting their tag on people's music for mixing it.
Yeah. I have a mix tag. I've never used it. I've only used it once before.
It's one of those things that's like, for something to become part of the culture, somebody has to start doing that and then people have to follow suit and then it becomes part of the culture, sure. It
never really caught on, huh?
It was one of those things where I was like, oh, this is a little, I'm not trying to talk shit, but it's a little corny. Like, I'm used to hearing a producer tag, but even then, growing up, we didn't really hear a lot of producer tags. We heard shout-outs. So, like, when producer tags started happening, I thought that was corny too, but then the culture caught on to it and that became part of the culture where like anytime I receive a mix that has a producer tag on it, I just leave it there unless the artist tells me to take it off. Yeah. But I have never heard anybody speak kindly of the guy that did the mixer tag. And I was like, ooh.
I have a mixer.
That was a big swing and a miss, unfortunately. I'm sure it was fine with like certain clients. Certain clients are like, yeah, tag it because I'm proud to be working with you, you know? But it's that's a risky one.
That's one way. But I have an old mix tag that I made years ago in my early years. Is I had this old Chilean, not old, I had a young Chilean rapper dude with an accent. Go like DK on the mix, bitch. And that was like, I've never used it. I've never used that on the tag.
Yeah.
I think that was like part of his rap and I just like took and sampled it, asked his permission and stuff. Anyway, but I think that's the end of this episode really is, and then, okay, hold on. Last minute advice, practical advice. Bad recordings is interesting. We didn't talk too much about like the quality of recording, so we'll finish it off with this. It's a simple thing. Again, we've already mentioned it a little bit. Like if you don't feel like you can work with bad recordings because you don't have the ability to fix it or change it enough to fit their expectations, that's one thing. I also think that if you communicate things correctly and we're both the provider and the requester of service, the service requester and the service provider, if both parties understand that there's a limited amount of action that can be taken for this bad, quote unquote, low quality recording, then I think that low quality recordings and bad recordings can actually be useful to the emotional aspect of the song.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's something like use the background noise to make it sound more intimate. Like use that to your advantage creatively. I think there's something to be said about that. But like if it doesn't match the expectations, they expect you to be able to make it completely clean and sterile, and they don't like your idea of like, yeah, that's probably something to say no to. So just understand, like, just because it's a quote unquote bad recording, you naming it a bad recording is probably more of an opinion, but just make sure that that opinion is aligned with the expectations of the artist.
Yep.
There's no such thing as bad. Japanese sound music exists. Like, that's a Japanese sound music is a genre. And as long as that exists, there's no such thing as bad recordings.
I wanted to ask you a question, but you could let me know if it's bordering on racist, but what is a Japanese sound?
How is that racist?
I don't know. That's like asking, like, what's a Mexican sound? Like, I guess it's because it's asking specifically about a culture's sound.
No. It's literally like, so Japan has this like really niche subgenre of music called like sound musics. And it's like, it's named like Japanese sound.
But does it sound like Japanese street traffic?
No, it's just like white noise. And like, it's just sound. It's not ambience. It is like electronic sounds.
Okay. Okay.
Like
from Japan.
Just look it up. It's a bunch of like hyper nerds in Japan that like, so okay, like, you I know, like, have you seen on YouTube, have you seen on YouTube, like the Japanese dude that uses like barcode scanners to make rhythm and like uses sounds with barcode scanners?
No.
There you go. Or like tapping old TV screens to make different sounds and noises.
So this sounds more like an artistic approach to outsider music.
It's definitely an artistic approach to outsider. I'm just kidding. That's a joke. No. It's just look it up. I'm not going to do it justice. I'm not going to honor what it actually is and what it stands for and why it's great.
I think I read way too into the name of it, like Japanese sound music. Like, what's a Japanese sound? Like, I know what a Japanese car is, and I know how to distinguish it between an American car. And one of the ways is you can tell is a Japanese car lasts longer, but, you know.
Yo, real quick, this is a big tangent. There's a big, on an episode of, what's that Larry David show? Oh my gosh. Curb Your Enthusiasm. That's what it was. Curb Your Enthusiasm. There's an episode where Larry David like goes to a Chinese restaurant and he asks the table with Chinese people, he's like, what are you ordering? He's like, why are you asking? He's like, well, you're like the experts. Like, I could just order whatever, but you should tell me what to order. Like, you're experts here. And the Chinese guy goes, well, it makes us experts. Wait, what do you think that makes us experts? Well, like, I wouldn't go to if there's two tables of skinny people and fat people, I'd ask the fat people because they were obviously like food, you know, they're experts. And he's like, well, why don't you just, anyway, so the Chinese people are offended, which is offensive to me as an Asian guy, because there is no Asian person ever that would be offended. That would be offended by like a non-Asian guy asking what's the best food to ask, because any Asian person in their right mind would be overly enthusiastic to share what's the goated food item specific to this shop even.
I would say that for Latino people too. Like, if you go to a Mexican restaurant and we know you don't speak Spanish or something, you're like, yo, what's the shit? Like, you gotta tell me.
Like, the writing of Chinese people being like really sensitive to racism is more racist than if they were to just ask like, what is like, no, you're right. I am the best person to ask for this. I will more than happy be tell you, because we are the experts and we love our food and our culture and we want to share that with you.
Yeah.
So it's just funny. It's just funny. Racism in the last 10 years has been like, semantics just has been like way, it's become anti-racism has become racist on accident, unintentionally. So that was like a really good example. How is that racist?
Yeah.
It was kind of funny
when I went to Switzerland, I had made a joke in passing with the band about like, you know, the only issue I have with going to Europe is not enough spice. Like, the Mexican in me is going in withdrawal, you know, like I just need some hot sauce or something, like give me some chile. And so we go to a curry spot and the chef brings out the curry. I start eating it and I'm so happy because I'm like, it's spicy curry and stuff like that. And the guy comes back, checks on the table, and the one of the band members is like, oh yeah, he really likes the food. He finally got some spice. And the guy looks at me, he's like, are you Mexican? And I was like, yes. Some people would say that that's like almost insulting to just think that it was Mexican just because I wanted more spice. But I'm like, no, this is exactly what's happening right now. I am factually Mexican going through withdrawals in Europe. Like, thank you for the spicy food. Thank you.
Dude, heck yeah. I think to this metaphor, to this tangent, this is going to be relatable. Because let's go back to the Larry David experience, right? If that Chinese group, that Chinese table wasn't there for food, but for a superiority, like we're Chinese and we're going to defend. So it's not about the food, it's about the culture.
Yeah.
Then you would be motivated to defend your culture and be like, no, this is us, don't ask us, whatever, become defensive.
Yeah.
But if you're focused on good food, if the priority is good food,
mm-hmm.
then you would gladly invite people to share the thing that you love. Yeah. It's not about a superiority or hierarchy of culture. It's about a love for food. And if the same thing, we can avoid a lot of personal biases and a lot of mistakes in the creative art of mixing if we focus that we love art and we make decisions for art in itself. Yeah. Not for a hierarchy, not for approval, not for validation. Because when you do it, make art or make creative decisions for any of those other things beyond art, that's when you accidentally say something stupid or do something stupid. Or make art that just sucks. It's like, yeah. It's fine. You got to do things for the art. So anyway, that's kind of like the end goal. That like wraps it up. Say yes or no for the sake of the art. Protect your love of art. All right. Another thing, maybe I'll do a little quick shout out. I've been writing on Substack recently. I've got like 2-3 articles out, depending on when this episode releases. And I'm writing more articles. They're very philosophical. They have a lot of data. They're not scientific research reports. But I'm writing. I'm writing a lot more to like collect my thoughts and to talk about things I think about from a day-to-day basis. If you're interested in any of that, there it's usually around like economics, philosophy, just culture in general and takeaways of that. Let me give you some topics while I'm selling you on it. I'm doing a write-up right now, which is fascinating. It'll be released on Wednesday this next week. The data is pretty clear that there's less predictive characteristics of bullies. So it's harder to predict who will become bullies than it is to predict who will become victims at the early ages and later ages in life. So it's comparing like the predictors and the characteristics of victims and the potential characteristics of bullies and how they're totally different and bullies are unpredictable. Anyway, I do like a cultural observation on like the social hierarchy of like pets that are now more like family members than they are just an accessory to families now, and like the dangers that can propose versus like my general declinism in perspective. I'm doing a write-up right now on like moral absolutism and how that can be dangerous and how you can change your perspective or how that's can be useful and where moral absolutism comes from within the scope of faith development and self-awareness based on other models that have been created by other scientists. And most of these write-ups are based on data and scientific research papers. If they are theories, then I will mention that they are theories. But they're just general things that I think of. Another one that I'm going to talk about, which will probably become a podcast episode, is like the idea of like Japanese craftsmanship. Why is it when it comes to like craftsmanship, Japan is subtly like unanimously accepted as like the highest quality craftsmanship around the world? At the cost of high price and low, low stock. Why is Japanese culture like create that sort of economic system? And we talk about that, and then I'm going to write about that, and we're probably going to make an episode about like how we can take on like this Japanese craftsmanship mentality into our mixes. Anyway, we're going to do a write up on that. Anyway, I'm talking way too much, but subscribe to my Substack. I'm doing it for fun. I'm not charging money for it or anything like that. Or if you want more specific episodes on technical details on how to mix, how to use a compressor, how to EQ and stuff like that, and how other people do it, go to mixingmusicpodcast.com/exclusive for exclusive episodes. There's already over 260 episodes out right now. And if you want to unlock all of those at once and more episodes in the future, mixingmusicpodcast.com/exclusive or /Patreon. They go to the same place. It's all hosted on Patreon at the moment. And on that note, happy mixing, my friends, and stay saucy.
I'm not exactly a tech genius, but I knew one thing for sure. If I wanted my small business to crush it, I needed a website that worked like a pro, and I needed it yesterday. Lucky for me, Bluehost made it ridiculously easy. With their AI design tools, building my website was a walk in the park. I could customize, optimize, and monetize everything exactly how I wanted. In just a few minutes, I had a secure site up and running. I couldn't believe how straightforward it was. And getting found online? Bluehost helped me with that, too. I perfected my keywords and meta descriptions with their search engine tools. The AI even gave me suggestions to improve my pages. Now I can sit back, relax, and focus on my customers, while my website continues to rank higher and higher on Google. With their 30-day money-back guarantee, I wasn't worried about taking the plunge. And now I'm so glad I did. Head over to Bluehost.com and build something special today.
Hey, it's Austin James. If you're like me, trying to live your best life while living with diabetes, you can relate to worrying if you're doing a good job managing your diabetes. I use the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor to get real-time glucose readings and see the impact of every meal and activity to make better decisions. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor can help me live life with diabetes on my own terms, and it gives me more time for the things I love, like being a dad and a musician. Now this is progress. Learn more at FreeStyleLibre.us.
For prescription only, safety info found at FreeStyleLibre.us.
If you love the Mixing Music Podcast but want deeper, ad-free, technical episodes, we've got you covered. Our Patreon gives you access to over 250 exclusive episodes and new content every single week, all focused on mixing, mastering, and engineering at a high level. For just $4 a month, you get practical tips and techniques that will instantly improve your sound. Join now at MixingMusicPodcast/exclusive.